I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Mitt Romney was declared the winner of the Iowa caucus early this morning, beating former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum by just 8 votes. Ron Paul came in a close third, followed by Newt Gingrich, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, and John Huntsman, who didn't even campaign in the state. Millions of dollars were spent on TV ads, almost half of them negative, and many funded by super PACs. Now the campaign moves on to New Hampshire, which holds its primary on Tuesday, January 10th. Joining us is Jonathan Aull, News Director for Iowa Public Radio. And Jonathan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
A pleasure to be here, Marty.
And Sean Trendy, also with us, Senior Elections Analyst for RealClearPolitics.com. He's got a brand new book called The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. And Sean Trendy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Jonathan, let me begin with you. Has there ever been such a close race in Iowa?
Not even close to this close. And I think that while the focus is going to be on that eight-vote margin between Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum, I think the bigger issue is that in the history of the Iowa caucuses on the Republican side, there's never been a time where three candidates have all gotten more than 20%. It's happened twice on the Democratic side, but it's never happened on the Republican side. So even, I think, a bigger takeaway than the eight-vote margin is the fact that the Iowa caucus goers really saw a top-tier candidate, and they gave more than 20% of the vote to three different candidates with very different ideologies, very different styles, very different campaigns. And it looks like today Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann will both drop out, and Newt Gingrich is hanging on rather precariously.
Well, Sean Trendy, what do you make of this caucus result?
You know, it's interesting. Mitt Romney didn't win among, of course, everyone's a registered Republican, but some people self-describe as independents. And Mitt Romney didn't win among either Republicans or among independents. And so I think that does point to something of a problem for Romney going forward. The question is whether there's anyone who can take advantage of that weakness. I think the candidate who is best positioned to do that is Rick Perry, and as was just noted, there's a good chance he's dropping out today.
Jonathan, let me go back to you. We're talking to you from Pennsylvania, and we don't do caucuses down here the way you do in Iowa. But it seems when you look at Rick Santorum and you compare him to Mitt Romney that they campaigned very differently in Iowa. Is that how you saw it?
Very much so, and I think that Rick Santorum didn't have any money. So he had to do it the old-fashioned way. He drove around in a pickup truck. He did more than 350 events leading up to the Iowa caucuses. He visited all 99 counties, and he did it the old-fashioned way with shoe leather. He did pretty well in the national debates, and he was very invested in the retail politics. That was the strategy that Mitt Romney tried 4 years ago in a lot of ways, although he had money 4 years ago, too. But he spent a lot of time in Iowa, and he didn't win. He came in second. So this time, Mitt Romney had a much more calculated, shrewd, and targeted way of approaching Iowa, maintaining that plausible
We're going to pull him down and see if we can fix that. Sean Trendy, let me go back to you and actually put another question on the table. What has made the Iowa caucuses so important? And is this really a media-manufactured phenomenon, or is there something significant about the Iowa caucus?
Well, I do think that it's significant. I mean, it's the first actual voting contest in the GOP primary, and it's a contest that's dominated by one of the more important factions in the GOP, social conservatives and white evangelicals. So it's important because it gives that faction of the Republican Party a chance to vote, and then it's kind of nice that you go then to New Hampshire, which is the more libertarian wing of the Republican Party.
I was reading some analysis this morning and looking at the three top candidates in Iowa. You've got a Chamber of Commerce type Republican. That was the description of Mitt Romney. You have the social conservative Rick Santorum, and then you have the isolationist, which of course would be Ron Paul. Do you think that expresses three very distinctive views within the GOP?
Absolutely. People forget that, you know, Iowa, going back to FDR and even to the First World War, has a long, call it isolationist, call it dovish tradition. And I think that Ron Paul kind of taps into the remnants of that, even within the GOP. And then with Mitt Romney, as you said, he did well, if you look at the map, in a lot of the suburban counties and up-and-coming counties. Polk County is very urban, Dubuque County. Rick Santorum, he ran well in the northwestern portion of the state, which is very conservative, and then in the rural counties. And part of that's a function of him visiting all those counties, and part of that's a function of him being emerging as the leading social conservative in the race at the end.
Jonathan Auld, do we have you back?
I hope so.
Good, without the echo there. What was the turnout yesterday in Iowa?
About 122,000, which was up from 4 years ago. Not as high as some people would have projected.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think that one of the things that the Iowa caucuses was lacking this year was the people who, for lack of a better way of putting it, were really dynamic on the stump. You know, 4 years ago, you had Mike Huckabee, who was, even if you didn't agree with anything he said, he was an engaging person to listen to. People could get really excited about him after they spent some time with him. And I think that the personalities and the speaking styles and the campaign styles of the people who were in the race this time didn't quite rise to that level. So I think that you really didn't have that kind of energy because they may not have liked that. They may not have had the gift of gab quite as well as some of the candidates 4 years ago.
And Jonathan, if 122,000 people voted in the caucuses, what percentage of that, how much does that represent of the Republican Party in Iowa?
Oh, somewhere about a quarter.
About 25%, something
yeah.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me pick up on the passion question, and I'll toss that to you, Sean Trendy. You have written a number of interesting things about Mitt Romney. One is that no one really loves him. I mean, they may end up liking him or having him in the end, but he doesn't seem to inspire passion.
Yeah, I think the analogy I used was he's like Molly Ringwald's character in 16 Candles. I mean, there's nothing wrong with him and cute and likable, but there's just not that kind of special click there right now, at least. And so that's potentially a problem for Romney going forward. No one really dislikes him. If you look at the polls, 60% of GOPers say they're fine with him. That's the second highest of all the candidates at the time that was polled. But the question is, assuming he's the nominee, when he gets to the general election, will he be able to set the Republican Party on fire to come out and vote for him? I think Barack Obama might do that for him, but it remains to be seen.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the Republican Party they loathe the president. That's the only word for it. Even if they don't necessarily turn out to vote for Mitt Romney, there's a good chance they'll turn out to vote against the president.
Let me pick up on that to you, Jonathan Auld. And we should say that the president was a presence in Iowa yesterday. There were Democrats out there working as well. What was going on the Democratic side?
Well, the Democrats hold caucuses just like in any other year. It just wasn't as interesting because the president wasn't challenged for the nomination, obviously. But more than 25,000 Democrats went out to caucus sites anyway. The party looked at it as an organizing process. They had the president on via internet at all of the sites. He answered some questions from some Iowa Democrats, and they were signing people up, and the Democratic Party claims that they have 7,500 people who signed up last night to campaign for the president, to make phone calls, to canvass their neighborhoods, and the volunteer effort. They said they signed up 7,500 new people. So it was an exercise for them to look toward the fall, although, you know, the Democratic Party in Iowa has been looking toward the fall for some time now. And they believe Mitt Romney is going to be the nominee because they've been slamming him every opportunity that they can get. One of the things they were doing in recent days leading up to the caucuses were parading around a gentleman who worked at one of the companies that Mitt Romney's investment group bought, and he was laid off as Romney's group tried to get that company back on track. So he was the guy that Mitt Romney fired, and they would parade him around wherever they could so that this guy could talk about how awful Mitt Romney was. So the Democrats believe they know who the nominee is, and they've been hammering on him for some time.
Jonathan, I was reading that something like $12 million was spent on ads in Iowa. what did that look and sound like?
Well, it had two different faces, because I think we really saw the influence of the super PACs and the Supreme Court decision that really eliminated a lot of the restrictions on these super PACs to raise money and spend money. And I think that Exhibit A in that impact was the millions of dollars that super PACs spent to have negative ads toward Newt Gingrich. And I think that was probably the number one thing that moved him from the front runner to fourth place, was this barrage of negative ads. And to put this in a little bit of context, that's estimated to have been about $3 million spent by super PACs on negative ads toward Newt Gingrich. In our gubernatorial campaigns, over an 18-month period, the candidates don't spend $3 million on TV ads. And in the course of a couple weeks, a super PAC spent that much targeting at one candidate. So that should give you some sense of the intensity that it had.
And Sean Trendy, picking up on this, that Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, how much do you think that is going to transform the presidential election going forward?
Well, I guess full disclosure, before I began being a political writer, I was a lawyer, and I did some Supreme Court advocacy on behalf of free speech organizations, so I do have a bias on this question. I think a lot of what Citizens United did is a lot of what McCain-Feingold did, kind of rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. The money flows wherever it's going to flow, and the super PACs are kind of a new creation for this corporate money to flow, but it was being spent in other ways beforehand. So I think the decision is significant, but I think it's as significant as a lot of commentators are making it out to be.
And I do want to pick up on that, but Jonathan, we have to say goodbye to you in about a minute. Is the general feeling in Iowa today good riddance to the national media that came into town to cover the caucuses? Goodbye to the candidates, good riddance?
It's a love-hate thing. I mean, Iowa loves being first. We love the attention. We love people coming here. We love having an influence on the process. But, yeah, the robocalls, the national media making vague generalizations about Iowa that they don't really know anything about, that part of it I think we're happy is over.
And what doesn't the national media understand about Iowa?
Well, they like to put everything in one-sentence phrases. They like to say that, you know, Republicans in Iowa are all evangelical, all very conservative, and social conservatives will always rule the day, and that's not always the case. The Republican Party in Iowa is a lot more diverse than the national media gives them credit for. They like to make generalizations about what they're looking for at the campaign stops when candidates come by, and they like to make generalizations about the urban-rural mix in Iowa, and a lot of journalists that parachute in probably do a little bit of a disservice to the state with their lack of knowledge.
Well, Jonathan, I appreciate you joining. I'm sure you've had a busy 24 hours. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. And Jonathan Aull is news director for Iowa Public Radio. Sean Trendy staying with us for the rest of the hour. We will continue our conversation talking about electoral politics and talking about his new book called The Lost Majority. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Brick Simple LLC proudly supports WHYY. Brick Simple provides technology consulting and software development for iPhone, iPad, Google Android, and web-based mobile applications. Details at BrickSimple.com.
NewsWorks.org is your source for smart stories that keep you better informed, better connected, and better prepared. Our network of quality journalists is a step above the rest, and better coverage of important issues means you'll always be a step ahead. NewsWorks is something different. News for people who ask more. News for people who care, by people who care. Get involved at NewsWorks.org. NewsWorks is, simply, news that works. Powered by WHYY and you.
This week in This American Life, at an apartment complex in New Hampshire, tenants' dogs were leaving doggy waste everywhere until the property manager took action.
And when one of my maintenance guys is walking through the door, he knows exactly what he'll be doing when he hears this.
What he'll be doing is taking a DNA sample of the errant poo this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Philadelphia Area Friends Schools support WHYY. For more than 300 years, Quaker Schools have offered strong educational programs grounded in ethical values. Details for open houses are online at quakerschools.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Last year in 2011, Republicans selected anyone but Mitt Romney to be their presidential candidate, choosing Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry, Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich, Ron Paul, Rick Santorum, even Donald Trump over the former Massachusetts governor in a variety of polls. Well, last night, Romney won the Iowa caucus, but not by much. He beat Santorum by just 8 votes. Sean Trendy is going to stay with us for the rest of the hour, senior elections analyst for Real Clear Politics.com, author of a brand new book called The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Sean, I do want to get to your book, but you also wrote an interesting article seeing some parallels between 1968 and today, between a frontrunner back in 1968 named Richard Nixon and Mitt Romney, who at least won the Iowa caucus last night. What are the parallels there that you see?
Well, I think it's important to note up front that the corruption issue is not a parallel. But setting aside Watergate, I think if you look at 1968, Richard Nixon was not beloved by the Republican Party. He had gone through kind of a series of political transformations from being a hardline anti-communist to being the establishment moderate. His slogan in 1968 was even, "I'm the new Nixon." And so it's kind of like Mitt Romney. And there was this succession of anti-Nixons in 1968. You had George Romney, Mitt Romney's father. You had Ronald Reagan, actually, at the end, and Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York. And ultimately, none of them could gain traction. None of them was ready for prime time. And at the end, the Republican Party just kind of shrugged its shoulders and said, "Okay, I guess it's Nixon."
And you think that might be how things will end once the primary season is over?
I think there's a very good chance of that. There's some chance that a Republican, you know, maybe Newt Gingrich gains traction in South Carolina. But right now, the money and the momentum is going to Romney, and I think he's the favorite.
Let me pick up on your comment about the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United. One of the criticisms, and I have frankly share this, is that we're talking about unlimited anonymous money. And it seems to me in a democracy, we should know who is spending what kind of money on a particular campaign or a particular candidate. And there are also questions about whether there actually is coordination between these super PACs and the candidate.
Yeah, and then you get into the question. I mean, the problem with this to some degree is that, you know, there is a constitutional right to anonymous speech. I mean, and it comes into tension then with the right of the electorate to fight corruption and to know who is giving money to different people. The thing about this corporate speech is that it's typically not a direct endorsement of a particular candidate, because then you start to run into in-kind contributions. It's not coordinated with the campaign, and so then you run into the questions of, well, you know, what is this political speech? If Reader's Digest runs an article praising Mitt Romney, do we have to know who is on Reader's Digest Foundation, who are the subscribers, etc.? There's a slippery slope that you can run down that becomes problematic.
But don't, and I don't have names at my fingertips here, but don't you see people running super PACs who are friends or used to work for some of these candidates?
Obviously, there's a problem determining what is truly an independent expenditure, and the FEC has spent an enormous amount of time trying to flesh this out. The question is, what is ultimately the most important value? Do you go for encouraging, you know, there's a chilling effect that can potentially occur if you start to run down these rabbit holes. And for me, it's just my value. I prefer free speech. If you look at the actual Citizens United case, it's not a friend. It's of one of the candidates, a guy who's made a movie about Hillary Clinton and
that's right.
Ran it through his company. And that's a long stretch from the coast, but it's hard to draw a clean line between them.
But you know what I think is interesting looking at Iowa is that the super PACs seem to be, you know, the bad guys doing the dirty work, saying all these negative things about Newt Gingrich, and the candidate themselves, Mitt Romney in this case, got to have a more sort of warm and fuzzy presence on television.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's, but at the end of the day, the question you have to ask yourself, for me, at least with regard to this money, is, you know, if a bunch of people want to get together and they think Mitt Romney is the best candidate for president, and they happen to be in a corporate form, not doing it individually, why shouldn't we allow that speech in a free democracy? It's core political speech that's always been protected by the First Amendment, and I think you have to allow it. I don't have a problem with enforcing disclosure provisions, you know, adding that on, and the BCRA, the original campaign law for individuals, has corporate disclosures. I think it's problematic, but at the end of the day, I think it's a good trade-off.
But there are limits on what an individual can give to an individual candidate.
And there's limits. I mean, corporations still can't give directly to candidates. There aren't limits on what an individual can spend on these individual expenditures, and now there aren't limits if they happen to do it in the corporate form.
Do negative ads work?
Yes.
And why?
Well, because most negative ads have some grain of truth, and while people don't like people getting down in the dirt, at the same time, negative ads are informative. They you know, kind of strip away some of the I'm trying to think of the word. They make it difficult for a candidate to only put their best face forward, and if you're going to elect a president of the United States, you want to know what the bad face is as well.
And they tend to be, people tend to remember the negative ads.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's one thing for a candidate to say, you know, I want to lower your taxes. It's another thing when the other candidate comes in and says, and, you know, in fact, this candidate raised taxes repeatedly when he was governor of his state. That makes a big impression on voters, and it can move the dial.
Well, I guess looking at negative ads, they're the ones that are true, and then they're ones that are not true. And it's important to make a distinction between those two.
Yeah, and it's another situation where, you know, we would love to get rid of untrue or misleading negative ads, but it's hard to do that without chilling truthful ads. And then you start asking the question, well, who is going to make these distinctions? And you go down a really nasty road that way. So I personally believe sunlight's the best disinfectant, and I've seen some great political ads where candidates who have been unfairly attacked have called their opponent on it and come out on top.
And looking ahead to New Hampshire, we should say that's in less than a week. It's next Tuesday. I don't know if you're in the prognostication business, Sean Trendy.
Yeah.
What do you predict?
I think Romney's going to have a healthy double-digit, maybe even 20-point win there. It's right next door to his state of Massachusetts. It's a state where he had a strong showing in 2008 until John McCain had his comeback, and I think he's going to win nicely.
And John Huntsman has really, you know, staked out a claim in New Hampshire. He didn't even really bother to campaign in Iowa. Do you think he's cooked?
I think so. Huntsman kind of made a bad decision at the beginning to try to run the old McCain strategy in a GOP that has very much changed from 2008 and even earlier in 2000. So he's tried to resuscitate himself to brandish his conservative credentials, which he is a conservative, but it's just, I think it's too late to turn back the clock.
And what's that McCain strategy that he's using?
Well, he was trying to run as kind of an outsider maverick, talking, you know, emphasizing some of his bipartisan credentials, and that's kind of what the GOP would have liked in 2000 and even to some extent in 2008, but not in a post-Tea Party GOP. You can't do that.
And that's Sean Trendy, Senior Elections Analyst for RealClearPolitics.com, author of a brand new book, in fact, published yesterday, called The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. Sean, let's get some callers in, and then we'll talk some about your book. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about, I guess I should say, this very early this morning, the fact that Mitt Romney won the Iowa caucus, although just by 8 votes, beating out, I guess, in quotation marks, Rick Santorum, former Pennsylvania senator. And we're taking calls again at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Gloria from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Gloria, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm from Iowa, and I haven't lived there in a long time, but I have a lot of friends and family there, and I do not find the caucuses to be very representative. They're basically meetings with strangers someplace in the cold, and many people do not go to them. I know my brothers vote in all the elections. They've never attended a caucus. I did when I lived there because I was really gung-ho for Shirley Chisholm, and our group went for Shirley Chisholm mainly because I brought tons of my friends along to the meeting.
Mm. And we're able to galvanize your friends. Well, that is one of the critiques, Sean Trendy, of the Iowa caucus, which is that it just really isn't representative.
Yeah, Shirley Chisholm, that's a blast.
I remember her well, indeed.
I believe she was the first African-American yes. woman to seek a major party nomination. Criticism that's frequently levied against caucuses. A lot of the research that's gone into them has suggested that at the end of the day, they end up being fairly representative of the two parties, a little bit more conservative than the state party for Republicans and more liberal for Democrats. But at the end of the day, it comes out in the wash.
One of the critiques I saw was that they are a glorified straw poll. Do you agree with that, Sean Trendy?
Yeah, I personally prefer primaries to caucuses. They encourage higher turnout, and they're less quirky. It's harder to work the kind of Byzantine aspects to them. But at the end of the day, you know, we've been using caucuses in this country for 200 years to pretty good effect. So I think they're good, mm-hmm. if not great.
Gloria, I'm just let me get Carrie from Wallingford to join our conversation. And Carrie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Hello.
Hi there.
I was thinking that the Republicans' strategy currently reminds me a lot of the Democratic strategy in 2004 when they selected John Kerry as the most electable candidate, figuring that the voter antipathy toward George W. Bush would be enough to motivate their voters and overturn the election. I would just wonder what their comments would be on that.
That's an interesting parallel there, Kerry. Let me see what Sean Trendy has to say. Sean?
I think the Republican answer after they thought about it is that Kerry almost won. He lost by 2.5 points and led for a lot of the race, and that was with an economy that was going well and a war in Iraq that had not clearly taken a turn for the worse yet. Barack Obama's approval rating is about 7% lower than George W. Bush's was on Election Day, and so, if George W. Bush had been situated where Barack Obama is today, he'd have lost in 2004 to John Kerry.
Mm. Interesting. Carrie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Sean, your book is called The Lost Majority, and I have to say there are big cross-out signs on the cover. What does that title mean, The Lost Majority?
Well, you'll notice that one of the X's is red and one of the X's is blue.
Yes.
And what it's kind of a reference to is that we hear almost after every election that this particular election is a realigning election that's going to usher in a new age of dominance for the political parties. In the late 90s and early 2000s, Republicans were talking about their permanent majority, Karl Rove in particular. And then a book by John Judas and Rue Tishara, a great book, Emerging Democratic Majority, predicted the opposite, especially after the 2006 and 2008 elections. My contention is there's never a permanent majority, that these majorities will always be lost quickly, because in a diverse country like ourselves, it's impossible to put together a long-term coalition. The parties will adapt, and it's hard to keep everyone on the same page for an extended period of time.
In fact, you look at 2008 when Democrats took the White House and Congress, and then, of course, in 2010, lost a majority in the House and almost lost a majority in the Senate.
That's right. If you look at the news after the 2008 elections, I mean, no one gave Republicans any chance of taking back the House because the story was there had been a realignment. There's the famous Newsweek cover, "We're all socialists now." A lot of the news columns were calling Barack Obama the next FDR. And we ended up with a situation where there was the second largest flip in the popular vote for the House in our country's history. And it's because it's hard to be as ambitious and to do things like Barack Obama clearly did. He did a lot of stuff. He had a very successful first term in terms of getting his policies through. But whenever you do a lot, you're going to alienate a large portion of of your coalition. And that's exactly what Obama and the Democrats did.
And inspired the Tea Party, you think?
Definitely inspired the Tea Party. And also, I mean, if you look at suburbanites, the Philadelphia suburbs are a classic example of an area of the country that had once been strongly Republican even through the 80s and then switched in the 1990s as the Democrats rebranded themselves as the party of social moderation and fiscal responsibility. Barack Obama, in a lot of ways, this isn't a criticism of his choices. He had to do some of this stuff, but he was not fiscally moderate in the Bill Clinton sense, and I think that's represented in the results you saw on the congressional level in the Philadelphia suburbs last year.
Where many Republicans won, or a number of Republicans won. In fact, some of the things you say about President Obama, that he has, or perhaps was, a much less transformative president than many believed. Can you expand on that?
Well, I think there's a lot of wishful thinking in the coverage of his 2008 win. People talked about the different map. But if you look at the map, the actual map, it looked a lot like Bill Clinton's. He won three states Clinton didn't, Iowa, Virginia, and North Carolina. But those states were actually pretty close in 1996 as well. What's interesting to me is that there were some states that Bill Clinton won handily in the Appalachian region, Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, Arkansas, where Barack Obama got absolutely blown out of the water. And so you had Barack Obama going deep into areas of Bill Clinton's coalition, minorities, suburbanites, young voters, but also narrowing that coalition by removing the Jacksonians and Appalachian voters from the Democratic coalition.
Do you think that's about race?
You know, that's a good question. I think the question you have to ask yourself, though, is why these voters would have stuck with the Democrats through the George McGovern candidacy and after a Willie Hortonized Michael Dukakis, when a lot of voters in the South did abandon the Democratic Party because of race, and yet flip right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure Barack Obama's skin tone is enough to really explain that. I think you have to look at the generalized leftward movement of the Democratic Party to explain that.
There is, I would say, some frustration on the left side of the Democratic Party with this president, saying that he hasn't been, you know, bold enough on certain issues, that he's been too willing to compromise. I mean, it seems that he is really in a damned if you do and damned if you don't position.
He absolutely is, and part of that is because of the campaign he ran. I mean, when your acceptance speech talks about stopping the waters from rising and healing the sick, you enthuse your base. Brendan Nyhan, a political scientist, has a great analogy, the Green Lantern theory of politics. And the Green Lantern, there's a ring that he wears, and only someone with enough power can control the ring. And there's this theory that if Barack Obama was stronger, he'd have been able to corral Congress and bent them to his will. I don't think so. I think he produced legislation that was as liberal as he possibly could, given the makeup of the Congress that he was governing. He still had 60 or 70 blue dogs he had to bring on board, and that was tough for him.
Well, and we're almost having a break here, and just picking up on what you said earlier, whether you liked it or not, if you look at the first 2 years of the Obama administration and what the president and the democratically controlled Congress were able to accomplish, it's pretty extraordinary. And as I said, you may like it, you may not like it, but they were able to get a lot done.
Absolutely. I mean, you start ticking off the list. I mean, there's the big items, the health care reform, the financial reform, the stimulus bill. And then you look at smaller things like credit card reform, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, the state children's health insurance program reauthorization that greatly expanded that. I mean, it was a very consequential Congress.
And that's Sean Trendy, senior elections analyst for RealClearPolitics.com, author of a brand new book called The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation and to our callers as well. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We can talk about the Iowa caucus results of last night or early this morning, and certainly talk about the state of electoral politics as well. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports WHYY and offers adult students the chance to earn an Ivy League bachelor's degree studying full-time or part-time and in the day or evening. Penn LPS welcomes transfer students and those just beginning their studies. Priority application deadline to receive financial aid packaging is March 15th. Details available online by searching Penn LPS, Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies.
The Showtime series Californication begins its new season this weekend. On The Next Fresh Air, we talk with one of the show's stars, Pamela Adlon. She's also played a recurring character on Louis C.K.'s series Louie. She was the voice of the 12-year-old boy, Bobby Hill, on King of the Hill, and has done the voices for lots of other animated characters. Join us this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. You might have a hard time booking a flight from Iowa to New Hampshire. We'll get the latest as the candidates head east and south. Also, singer Betty Wright, the force behind J-Lo and so many others. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Sean Trendy about electoral politics. This just in from Politico. Michelle Bachmann has scrapped plans to campaign in South Carolina, has called a press conference for this morning in Des Moines, Iowa. According to the Associated Press, that press conference will take place at 11 o'clock this morning. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Sean Trendy, I don't know what Michelle Bachmann is going to say. I know what the speculation and rumors are. What do you make of her candidacy?
You know, she was kind of the first, not Romney, to emerge in Iowa, if you discount Donald Trump, who didn't run. You know, she is a very conservative candidate. She had only been in the House for 4 years, I think, so not necessarily ready when the spotlight shone on her. And I think she also had some bad timing. She won Iowa, the Iowa straw poll, the day Rick Perry got in, and he kind of sucked a lot of the political oxygen out of the space.
Let me see what Andrew from California has to say. And Andrew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My biggest problem is a voter, and I've been voting since 1980. It was my first election, and I vote every election. My biggest problem is, as I've gotten older, I've seen that we have this growing distance between the far ends of each party to the point where they're not really cooperating anymore. And I think the lost majority in this country are the moderates. We're sick and tired of seeing both these parties drift to the extreme, and then once they get into Congress, to be so far apart that they're not willing to compromise. And I think it's gotten worse with the Tea Party and the GOP. I think that their pledge to Grover Norquist has made it almost impossible to get any sort of legislation passed to help this country out during the Depression.
Well, Andrew, I appreciate the call. Let me give Sean Trendy a chance to respond. What do you think, Sean?
Well, in one sense, he's absolutely right. If you go back before 1930, we didn't have ideological parties in this country. We had sectional parties, and that started to change in the 1930s. And it's finally grown to a head today where we have kind of a neatly conservative Republican Party. But the flip side is we also have a neatly liberal Democratic Party, especially after this last election when a lot of the blue dogs lost. So I think compromise is increasingly difficult to come by, absolutely, but I also think there's been polarization among the Democrats as well as among Republicans.
Do you think equal polarization?
I think it's been, if you look in the big picture, yeah, I think the Democratic Party today bears very little resemblance to the Bill Clinton Democrats, especially if you look at the second half of his term. At the same time, I think that the Republican Party today bears very little resemblance to the Republican Party there was under Eisenhower and Nixon.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about John Boehner right before Christmas trying to, you know, corral some members of his party around some of these important issues.
Well, I think if you see the Democrats come back in 2012 or 2014, it's going to be a blue dogless Democratic coalition, and I think you're going to see a lot of similar effect. Even with the health care bill, I mean, there was a real threat that some of the liberals would defect because they didn't want taxpayer money going to private insurance companies, and it took a lot of effort to get them all on board at the end. I think that's only going to increase in the next few years, especially with the Occupy Wall Street movement, if it survives the winter.
So you see politics becoming more and more partisan, and we shouldn't pretend that there haven't been partisan politics in the past, but looking at today's environment, Sean, you see a more angry partisan political system?
Absolutely. And in a sense, the winners are moderates because they are increasingly the ones who decide where this country goes. Now, they might not like the choice between a liberal Democrat and a very liberal Democrat and a very conservative Republican. That's also part of why I think we've seen the pendulum swinging so abruptly in recent races, is that, you know, the independents put the Democrats in and they don't really like what they're doing, so they turn around and they put the Republicans in, don't like what they're doing, and go back and forth.
Well, and independents are an interesting challenge to both parties, Republican and Democrat.
That's right. And one of the interesting things is that although I think the parties have grown more polarized, the fastest growing political affiliation in this country is still independent. And so we've had what political scientists call a process of de-alignment, where people are kind of leaving the parties. Now, some of those independents think the Democrats are sellouts for being too conservative and vice versa with the Republicans. But there's a lot of people just disaffected with where the parties are going.
Let me get, looks like John from Old City to join our conversation. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've got a comment that I guess I'd like the guest to respond to.
Sure.
He was speaking earlier about Citizens United and how that's, you know, basically a good thing because that's, you know, corporate money going into politics as free speech. And my, and I'm for sort of a 28th Amendment that would overturn Citizens United, but I do think that sort of free speech argument is attenuated. Corporate effort brings groups of people together to do things mostly to make money, and so that making money is a value people share, but I don't think people investing in a mutual fund necessarily think that the, you know, a gas company or an oil companies or coal-fired power, like, is like if they're spending money to move their agenda forward, that doesn't necessarily reflect the views and values of people who might have just disinterestedly invested in a mutual fund. And so aggregating millions or billions of dollars collectively and then handing control to a small group of people to then spend that money for political purposes, I think it's an attenuated free speech argument. And then the far more obvious sort of tit for tat or quid pro quo when money comes in, I think does corrupt politics. And
well,
I guess if you could.
Yeah, go ahead, Sean Trendy.
Well, the First Amendment's text is pretty unequivocal. It says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. It's the most unequivocal language we find in the Constitution. And so it doesn't really allow for us to say, well, we don't like this type of speech. But I think the bigger point is that, again, you have to look at the facts of Citizens United. We like to think, or, you know, when we're talking about these, our instantaneous response is to think about Microsoft or a coal company or whatever your least favorite group is. But Citizens United wasn't about that. It was about a small group of individuals who wanted to run an ad or a movie attacking Hillary Clinton. And that's kind of the core of political speech, and it's just very difficult to draw a line between those people and a big company. There is no way to draw a bright line. And in this country, because the First Amendment is so core to our country's values, we just don't draw the line.
But when the First Amendment is tied to money, I mean, the more money you have in our system, the more speech you have.
Well, that's right. I mean, people like to make the argument that, you know, well, money isn't speech and spending money isn't speech. But you could say that about anything. You know, you can say money isn't abortion and say, well, then Congress can just pass a law saying you can't spend any money on abortions and overturn Roe v. Wade through that backdoor method. And money is everything. It's a neutral. That's the reason we have it, is it's a neutral thing that you can spend to turn into just about any commodity or service in the country.
But, I mean, and this is an obvious argument here, but that gives those people with more money then more clout, more power to influence politics and policies.
Well, it does. And those individual, if you didn't have corporate form, those people could spend it individually. And there's always been an option for corporate PACs. And that was my earlier point about, you know, the money just kind of, you're kind of reshuffling shares. Corporate PACs could always spend money on campaigns. And so corporations would send things from their treasury to corporate PACs. Now they just spend it directly from their treasury, and there's not really that much difference. And again, at the end of the day, the First Amendment doesn't allow us to make those distinctions. Its text is unequivocal.
And that's Sean Trendy, senior elections analyst, for Real Clear Politics, author of a new book called The Lost Majority. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Sean, you wrote something in Real Clear Politics back in December, and it's headlined in Pennsylvania, "The Gerrymander of the Decade?" question mark. back. And you talk about the redistricting going on in the state of Pennsylvania. Gerrymander of the decade?
Absolutely. It is almost impossible to take a 55% Obama state and make 75% of the districts lean towards Republicans, but the Pennsylvania GOP seems to have done it.
Well, and just and they did it by redrawing some allowing some vulnerable Republicans to be in stronger districts.
That's right. And the flip side is that some of the vulnerable Democrats find themselves in safer districts as well. Tim Holden in Berks County now sees his district run up to Wilkes-Barre and Scranton. And it's a heavily blue district now, whereas before it was kind of a swing district. Jim Gerlach, and I can't remember the new congressman's name from the 7th, and then Mike Fitzpatrick in the 8th, both got redder districts as a result.
Would that be Lou Barletta?
Lou Barletta, he's Hazleton. It used to have the Wilkes-Barre Scranton stuff, but now he gets a lot of central Pennsylvania. His district moves something like 10 points towards the Republicans. It was astounding.
But don't you think redistricting then polarizes people even more?
To a certain extent, I think that's true. We've always had gerrymandering. It's a little bit, it's better today. I mean, the maps are more convoluted, but if you look back to the 1880s, the Republicans and Democrats redistricted Ohio 4 times in that decade as they took charge of the House and were successful. I mean, they would wipe out 5 or 10 members of the other party. And so that's something that's been going on forever, and you can't explain change with a constant. I think the polarization comes more from the fact that we're a more ideological country. We're a more diverse country than we were 100 years ago, and that invites ideological polarization.
Let me get, looks like Paul from Bucks County to join our conversation. And, Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
thank you very much. First of all, I just have to make a real quick comment. A little bit earlier, you were talking about the Democratic disenchantment with Obama, which to me just seems nuts. He walked into a collapsing economy brought about by Republican deregulation, which put a lot of people out on the street homeless. And even though Timothy Geithner is not the most popular guy in the world, together they basically saved this economy, and it's chugging along pretty good right now, in my opinion. The question is, after these primaries, after these Republicans say mean things about each other, do you all think it's possible that they will come together with a Romney-Santorum ticket, which would have the effect of the broad, I guess what you call Christian conservative appeal with Santorum offsetting whatever reservations people might have about Romney being a Mormon?
Well, that's interesting, Paul. Sean, can you imagine a Romney-Santorum ticket?
Well, you know, it would be an interesting ticket for a number of reasons. Obviously, Santorum has appeal to conservative Christians that Romney lacks. There's some interesting geographical diversity. But the most interesting thing about Rick Santorum is his appeal to blue-collar voters, because that's a constituency that has never been a fan of Barack Obama. They're kind of ripe for the picking this election. And if you listen to Rick Santorum's speech last night, if you're up that late, he did a very good job outlining an argument that would appeal to those voters. Ultimately, I think Romney goes south, maybe Latino with Susana Martinez in New Mexico or Marco Rubio. But Santorum's an interesting pick that I hadn't thought of.
Well, but what's interesting, looking at some of these blue-collar voters, and this is speaking broadly, obviously, but there's been a fair amount of union bashing coming from the Republican side of the political divide here, and union members, even teachers, they're white-collar, but nonetheless, I think that's in many ways people identify with unions and might call themselves blue-collar as well.
I think if the Democrats had, you know, Bill Clinton in the White House, had, Bob Casey in the White House, had someone with more appeal to the white working class than Barack Obama, who, you know, aside from race, is culturally very much with the 1% in style and tone, I think Mitt Romney would have huge vulnerabilities there. I'm just not sure Barack Obama is the right candidate to exploit those vulnerabilities.
And how is he culturally tied to 1%?
Well, if you think about him, and I mean the words that people use to describe him, and it tends to be more critical, but you know, cerebral, professorial, Spock-like, to use Marine Dad's favorite phrase. And I don't think that's really what blue-collar workers are looking for. I mean, they're looking for authenticity. They're looking for straight talk. That's why John McCain actually did pretty well about with them until the financial collapse. Mitt Romney does not connect with blue-collar voters, but I think that Barack Obama is even further disconnected from them.
You don't see him as an authentic candidate or even an authentic president?
I think for what blue-collar voters want to hear, I don't think they're inspired by his rhetoric the way that, say, college students are, people with graduate degrees, and to a lesser extent, people with college degrees are. It's just a different type of rhetoric and a different emphasis on policies and politics.
But when you look, as you mentioned, the various accomplishments that President Obama is able to create, certainly under the first 2 years of office, a lot of that went to help blue-collar voters. I'm thinking of even the bailout of the auto industry, which many people criticized, but nonetheless, those were blue-collar, working-class people whose jobs were saved by the president.
You know, it's something of an irony of his presidency. There was a debate kind of in the political geek world of coalitions. Should Obama have a Colorado strategy or an Ohio strategy? The Ohio strategy focusing on blue-collar voters and the Colorado strategy focusing more on upscale voters. And that's the irony, is that he has been kind of trying an Ohio strategy for the last 2 years, and it hasn't yielded dividends. His approval rating is 33% among whites, and it's even lower among blue-collar whites.
But you think that's style or substance?
I think when you look at, when you look at the substance of what Barack Obama has done, you would expect him to do a little bit better among the white working class. So I think style has a lot to do with it. I do think the white working class is a little more complex than people, as you noted. We're generalizing here. White blue-collar voters in unions are a much smaller portion of the blue-collar class than they were 40 years ago. Public employee unions are more the rule today. And even then, Republicans still tend to get 50% of the vote from unions, largely because of cultural issues. More like 40%. But so I think that's a complex question, why Barack Obama just is falling flat among these voters.
Well, it will be an interesting year. Sean Trendy, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's senior elections analyst for RealClearPolitics.com, author of a new book called The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.